Chapter 22. Really liked. Coenda dropped back into his armchair, his shock head embedded in its habitual hollow, his little eyes glimmering over a fresh cigar. Liked? Good lord. He growled. Ah, you have, then. Frenum pounced on him in the same instant, with a sidewise glance of victory at me. But Cohen cowered gnome-like among his cushions, dissembling himself in a protective cloud of smoke. What's the use of denying it? You've seen everything, so of course you've seen a ghost, his young friend persisted, talking intrepidly into the cloud. Oh, or, if you haven't seen one, it's only because you've seen two. The form of the challenge seemed to strike our host. He shot his head out of the mist with a queer tortoise-like motion he sometimes had, and blinked approvingly at Frenum. Yes, he suddenly flung at us on a shrill jerk of laughter. It's only because I've seen two. The words were so unexpected that they dropped down and down into a fathomless silence, while we continued to stare at each other over Cohen's head, and Cohen stared at his ghosts. At length Frenum, without speaking, threw himself into the chair on the other side of the hearth, and leaned forward with his listening smile. ... Two? Oh, of course they're not show ghosts, a collector wouldn't think anything of them. ... Don't let me raise your hopes, their one merit is their numerical strength. The exceptional fact of their being two. But, as against this, I'm bound to admit that at any moment I could probably have exorcised them both, by asking my doctor for a prescription, or my oculist for a pair of spectacles. Only, as I never could make up my mind, whether to go to the doctor or the oculist, whether I was afflicted by an optical, or a digestive delusion, I left them to pursue their interesting double life, though at times they made mine exceedingly comfortable. ... Yes, uncomfortable. And you know how I hate to be uncomfortable. But it was part of my stupid pride, when the thing began, not to admit that I could be disturbed by the trifling matter of seeing two, and then I'd no reason, really, to suppose I was ill. As far as I knew, I was simply bored, horribly bored. But it was part of my boredom, I remember, that I was feeling so uncommonly well, and didn't know how on earth to work off my surplus energy. I had come back from a long journey down in South America and Mexico, and had settled down for the winter near New York, with an old aunt who had known Washington Irving, and corresponded with N.P. Willis. She lived, not far from Irvington, in a damp Gothic villa, overhung by Norway spruces, and looking exactly like a memorial emblem done in hair. Her personal appearance was in keeping with this image, and her own hair, of which there was little left, might have been sacrificed to the manufacture of the emblem. I had just reached the end of an agitated year, with considerable arrears to make up in money and emotion, and theoretically it seemed as though my aunt's mild hospitality would be as beneficial to my nerves as to my purse. But the deuce of it was that, as soon as I felt myself safe and sheltered, my energy began to revive, and how was I to work it off inside of a memorial emblem? I had, at that time, the agreeable illusion that sustained intellectual effort could engage a man's whole activity, and I decided to write a great book, I forget about what. My aunt, impressed by my plan, gave up to me her Gothic library, filled with classics in black cloth and daguerreotypes of faded celebrities. And I sat down at my desk, to make myself a place among their number. And to facilitate my task, she lent me a cousin to copy my manuscript. The cousin was a nice girl, and I had an idea that a nice girl was just what I needed to restore my faith in human nature, and principally in myself. She was neither beautiful nor intelligent, poor Alice Nowell, but it interested me to see any woman content to be so uninteresting, and I wanted to find out the secret of her content. In doing this, I handled it rather rashly, and put it out of joint, oh, just for a moment. There's no fatuity in telling you this, for the poor girl had never seen anyone but cousins. Well, I was sorry for what I'd done, of course, and confoundedly bothered as to how I should put it straight. She was staying in the house, and one evening, after my aunt had gone to bed, she came down to the library to fetch a book she'd mislaid, like any artless heroine on the shelves behind us. She was pink-nosed and flustered, and it suddenly occurred to me that her hair, though it was fairly thick and pretty, would look exactly like my aunt's when she grew older. I was glad I had noticed this, for it made it easier for me to do what was right. And when I had found the book she hadn't lost, I told her I was leaving for Europe that week. Europe was terribly far off in those days, and Alice knew at once what I meant. She didn't take it in the least, as I'd expected it would have been easier if she had. She held her book very tight, and turned away a moment to wind up the lamp on my desk. It had a ground glass shade with vine leaves and glass drops around the edge, I remember. Then she came back, held out her hand, and said, "Goodbye." And as she said it, she looked straight at me and kissed me. I had never felt anything as fresh and shy and brave as her kiss. It was worse than any reproach, and it made me ashamed to deserve a reproach from her. I said to myself, "I'll marry her, and when my aunt dies she'll leave us this house, and I'll sit here at the desk and go on with my book, and Alice will sit over there with her embroidery and look at me as she's looking now. And life will go on like that for any number of years." The prospect frightened me a little, but at the time it didn't frighten me as much as doing anything to hurt her. And 10 minutes later she had my seal ring on my finger, and my promise that when I went abroad she should go with me. You'll wonder why I'm enlarging on this familiar incident. It's because the evening on which it took place was the very evening on which I first saw the queer sight I've spoken of. Being at that time an ardent believer in a necessary sequence between cause and effect, I naturally tried to trace some kind of link between what had just happened to me in my aunt's library and what was to happen a few hours later on the same night, and so the coincidence between the two events always remained in my mind. I went up to bed with rather a heavy heart, for I was bowed under the weight of the first good action I had ever consciously committed. And young as I was, I saw the gravity of my situation. Don't imagine from this that I had hitherto been an instrument of destruction. I had been merely a harmless young man who had followed his bent and declined all collaboration with Providence. Now I had suddenly undertaken to promote the moral order of the world, and I felt a good deal like the trustful spectator who has given his gold watch to the conjurer, and doesn't know in what shape he'll get it back when the trick is over. Still, a glow of self-righteousness tempered my fears, and I said to myself as I undressed that when I'd got used to being good it probably wouldn't make me as nervous as it did at the start. And by the time I was in bed, and had blown out my candle, I felt that I really was getting used to it, and that, as far as I'd got, it was not unlike sinking down into one of my aunt's very softest wool mattresses. I closed my eyes on this image, and when I opened them, it must have been a good deal later, for my room had grown cold, and the night was intensely still. I was waked suddenly by the feeling we all know, the feeling that there was something near me that hadn't been there when I fell asleep. I sat up and strained my eyes into the darkness. The room was pitch black, and at first I saw nothing, but gradually a vague glimmer at the foot of the bed turned into two eyes staring back at me. I couldn't see the face attached to them on account of the darkness, I imagined, but as I looked the eyes grew more and more distinct. They gave out a light of their own. The sensation of being thus gazed at was far from pleasant, and you might suppose that my first impulse would have been to jump out of bed and hurl myself on the invisible figure attached to the eyes. But it wasn't. My impulse was simply to lie still. I can't say whether this was due to an immediate sense of the uncanny nature of the apparition, to the certainty that if I did jump out of bed I should hurl myself on nothing, or merely to the benumbing effect of the eyes themselves. They were the very worst eyes I've ever seen. A man's eyes, but what a man. My first thought was that he must be frightfully old. The orbits were sunk, and the thick red-lined lids hung over the eyeballs like blinds, of which the cords are broken. One lid drooped a little lower than the other, with the effect of a crooked leer, and between these pulpy folds of flesh, with their scant bristle of lashes, the eyes themselves, small glassy discs with an agate-like rim about the pupils, looked like sea pebbles in the grip of a starfish. But the age of the eyes was not the most unpleasant thing about them. What turned me sick was their expression of vicious security. I don't know how else to describe the fact that they seemed to belong to a man who had done a lot of harm in his life, but had always kept just inside the danger lines. They were not the eyes of a coward, but of someone much too clever to take risks, and my gorge rose at their look of base astuteness. Yet even that wasn't the worst, for as we continued to scan each other I saw in them a tinge of faint derision, and felt myself to be its object. At that I was seized by an impulse of rage that jerked me out of bed, and pitched me straight on the unseen figure at its foot. But of course there wasn't any figure there, and my fists struck at emptiness. Ashamed and cold, I groped about for a match, and lit the candles. The room looked just as usual as I had known it would, and I crawled back to bed, and blew out the lights. As soon as the room was dark again the eyes reappeared, and I now applied myself to explaining them on scientific principles. At first I thought the illusion might have been caused by the glow of the last embers in the chimney, but the fireplace was on the other side of my bed, and so placed that the fire could not possibly be reflected in my toilet glass, which was the only mirror in the room. Then it occurred to me that I might have been tricked by the reflection of the embers in some polished bit of wood or metal, and though I couldn't discover any object of the sort in my line of vision, I got up again, groped my way to the hearth, and covered what was left of the fire. But as soon as I was back in bed the eyes were back at its foot. They were an hallucination, then. That was plain. But the fact that they were not due to any external dupery didn't make them a bit pleasanter to see. For if they were a projection of my inner consciousness, what the deuce was the matter with that organ? I had gone deeply enough into the mystery of morbid pathological states to picture the conditions under which an exploring mind might lay itself open to such a midnight admonition, but I couldn't fit it to my present case. I had never felt more normal, mentally and physically, and the only unusual fact in my situation, that of having assured the happiness of an amiable girl, did not seem of a kind to summon unclean spirits about my pillow. But there were the eyes still looking at me. I shut mine, and tried to evoke a vision of Alice Nowell's. They were not remarkable eyes, but they were as wholesome as fresh water, and if he had had more imagination, or longer lashes their expression might have been interesting. As it was, they did not prove very efficacious, and in a few moments I perceived that they had mysteriously changed into the eyes at the foot of the bed. It exasperated me more to feel these glaring at me through my shut lids than to see them, and I opened my eyes again, and looked straight into their hateful stare. And so it went on all night. I can't tell you what that night was, nor how long it lasted. Have you ever lain in bed, hopelessly wide awake, and tried to keep your eyes shut, knowing that if you opened them, you'd see something you dreaded and loathed? It sounds easy, but it's devilish hard. Those eyes hung there and drew me. I had the vertige de labum, and their red lids were the edge of my abyss. I had known nervous hours before. Hours when I'd felt the wind of danger in my neck, but never this kind of strain. It wasn't that the eyes were so awful, they hadn't the majesty of the powers of darkness. But they had, how shall I say? A physical effect that was the equivalent of a bad smell. Their look left a smear like a snail's. And I didn't see what business they had with me, anyhow, and I stared and stared, trying to find out. I don't know what effect they were trying to produce, but the effect they did produce was that of making me pack my portmanteau and bolt to town early the next morning. I left a note for my aunt, explaining that I was ill and had gone to see my doctor, and as a matter of fact I did feel uncommonly ill. The night seemed to have pumped all the blood out of me. But when I reached town I didn't go to the doctor's. I went to a friend's rooms, and threw myself on the bed, and slept for 10 heavenly hours. When I woke it was the middle of the night, and I turned cold at the thought of what might be waiting for me. I sat up, shaking, and stared into the darkness. But there wasn't a break in its blessed surface, and when I saw that the eyes were not there I dropped back into another long sleep. I had left no word for Alice when I fled, because I meant to go back the next morning. But the next morning I was too exhausted to stir. As the day went on the exhaustion increased, instead of wearing off like the lassitude left by an ordinary night of insomnia. The effect of the eyes seemed to be cumulative, and the thought of seeing them again grew intolerable. For 2 days I struggled with my dread. But on the third evening I pulled myself together and decided to go back the next morning. I felt a good deal happier as soon as I decided, for I knew that my abrupt disappearance and the strangeness of my not writing must have been very painful for poor Alice. That night I went to bed with an easy mind and fell asleep at once, but in the middle of the night I woke and there were the eyes. Well, I simply couldn't face them, and instead of going back to my aunt's I bundled a few things into a trunk, and jumped onto the first steamer for England. I was so dead tired, when I got on board, that I crawled straight into my berth, and slept most of the way over, and I can't tell you the bliss it was to wake from those long stretches of dreamless sleep and look fearlessly into the darkness, knowing that I shouldn't see the eyes. I stayed abroad for a year, and then I stayed for another, and during that time I never had a glimpse of them. That was enough reason for prolonging my stay if I'd been on a desert island. Another was, of course, that I had perfectly come to see, on the voyage over, the folly, complete impossibility, of my marrying Alice Nowell. The fact that I had been so slow in making this discovery annoyed me, and made me want to avoid explanations. The bliss of escaping at one stroke from the eyes, and from this other embarrassment, gave my freedom an extraordinary zest, and the longer I savored it the better I liked its taste. The eyes had burned such a hole in my consciousness, that for a long time I went on puzzling over the nature of the apparition, and wondering nervously if it would ever come back. But as time passed I lost this dread, and retained only the precision of the image. Then that faded in its turn. The second year found me settled in Rome, where I was planning, I believe, to write another great book, a definitive work on Etruscan. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.